social security cards, birth certificates, and passports, along with records such as property deeds and vehicle titles. You'll also need financial and legal documents such as wills, tax returns, and bank statements. And don't forget your health and home insurance policies, which you may need in order to get medical care during an emergency and to rebuild afterwards. Then make copies of everything. Keep one copy in a secure place, like a safety deposit box, and put another copy in a go bag with emergency supplies that you can grab if a disaster hits. You can also store copies digitally in a password-protected hard drive or in the cloud. As the climate warms, disasters like floods, wildfires, and hurricanes will become more common and severe across the country. So everyone should make a plan to keep important documents safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 3rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Eric Galatis, Farah Siddiqui, Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. All of our KBOO program, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Today's episode features the second half of my interview with University of Oregon professor and longtime activist Sarah Wald. In part one, we talked about Sarah's background in activism, why we need a justice-oriented response to public lands attacks, the power of narratives in activism, the exclusionary history of some parts of the conservation movement, and a lot more. Today, we get into the threat of ecofascism, we talk about creating lasting allyship within the movement, and one of my personal favorite topics, is the environmental movement suffering from trade-off denialism? That is our desire to prevent harm paralyzing our ability to make progress on decarbonization? You can hear the entire interview, along with all of our five-year catalog, by searching for Coast Range Radio on any podcast app. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. I would love to hear what you think of this conversation. Okay, so I started off by asking Sarah about a dynamic that I've seen in the environmental and conservation world. Activists and organizations will sometimes pick and choose who to lift up as legitimate in marginalized communities, especially within indigenous and tribal voices, highlighting only the people within those communities whose position on an issue aligns with an organization's pre-existing policy desires. And I'm not excluding myself from this. I have definitely been a part of organizations that have done this. I've done it myself. A really timely example of this would be the fight over the Thacker Pass mine near the Oregon-Nevada border. The Thacker Pass project has enormous lithium deposits and could be really beneficial for a green energy transition, but it is highly controversial. There are multiple tribes who have claim to that land. Some are opposed and some are in favor. Yet many of the activists I've spoken with about it only seem to recognize tribal voices who are opposing the project as legitimate. And without taking a position one way or the other, asked Sarah how it would look to form a deeper, more holistic approach to allyship.
I'm really glad that you brought this question up. I think it's really important to recognize that Indigenous voices are not a monolith. Indigenous communities and tribal nations do not always want the same things. There are many tribal nations that support extractive projects that I am personally very uncomfortable with. And it creates a challenge for me to say, I support tribal sovereignty. And there are tribal nations that want projects that I disagree with. And supporting tribal sovereignty sometimes means I have to stand with tribal nations and their right to tribal sovereignty that are engaging in things that I don't think are good projects or just projects. And I do think that I see environmental groups not only picking and choosing which tribal nations to stand with or which indigenous voices from within tribal communities to stand with, but also standing with tribal sovereignty on the surface and yet picking and choosing among recommendations from a specific tribal nation. I think one thing is to really think about values, leading with values. Do I support tribal sovereignty? Do I support land back? Do I support co-management if we can't do land back? And how does that maybe mean standing with things that I'm comfortable with and where my values really are? So I think that's one thing I would encourage people to think about when facing that. And I also think it's not my place to decide which, I think there's a real problem in that the way that minoritized or marginalized voices in the U.S. operate is people are also often forced into a position of representation or that they're not asking for, right? Like I'm very rarely assumed to speak for all university professors.
Right.
I am not assumed to speak for, there's not a community that I am sort of assumed to be speaking for at any given moment. And yet somebody on the basis of being Indigenous is assumed to speak for all tribes or all Indigenous people. And they're not, you know, not what that person is trying to do. And so be aware of whether you're, you know, if you're working with somebody, are you working with someone who's speaking for the tribe? Are they an Indigenous person who's speaking for themselves and not trying to make broader claims? And then keeping the value of standing with tribal sovereignty and land back front and center, even when it's uncomfortable. I guess that's what I'd say. I'm not going to pretend it's an easy solution or that there's sort of easy answers to complicated issues and coming out of, you know, as you said, I think that phrase of complicated love for public lands rings true in trying to figure out how to stand when, how to stand on issues where there is a diversity of opinions among tribal sovereignty, you know, among tribal nations that make sort of standing with tribal sovereignty seem more complicated than it might if everybody was aligned.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I mean, I agree. It's just, it's complicated. There's no easy answers there. And people need to, like you say, get clear on their values personally or organizationally and stand with those values. And so it's maybe it's okay if you disagree with, you know, a tribal nation or tribal activist groups or Latino activist groups on this issue or that issue. But as long as you're coming authentically, you know, I think there's going to be, you're going to be able to still build that mutual respect, which is obviously really important.
Could I add one more thing that I think is important to mention?
Oh, please.
I just want to say, it's not my place to manage intertribal disagreements. And I think sometimes white conservationists come into a moment and think that it is their place to manage intertribal disagreements or decide whose voices or which tribes are legitimate. And it's not. I don't think that's the place of white conservationists and white environmentalists and white public lands advocates. I think the place of those groups in a justice-oriented framework is to support land back, support tribal sovereignty, and support co-management.
Thanks for adding that. My final question on this larger theme bucket is, so I'm a white guy who didn't even finish high school, but I'm very concerned with social justice, climate justice, all of this. I find, and I'm sure I'm not alone here, but just speaking for myself, you know, I'm often really in my head about, oh, am I saying the wrong thing? Am I coming off disrespectfully? And I feel like sometimes I'm probably too in my head. How do we incorporate some of these things, some of, you know, terms that might not feel super comfortable or second nature to some of us without overthinking it or being weird and awkward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important question. I'm going to suggest three things. One, I think whenever possible, you know, uplift Indigenous speakers, amplify Indigenous voices, and support tribal sovereignty. I try not to speak for folks. There's plenty of times I get invited to speak or talk to the media, and I say, I'm not the right person for that. And so I think always being willing to really think about, am I the right person to talk on this topic? Who else can I be suggesting? Or is this a moment in which I actually should step back and let somebody else speak? I think that that is a key value here. Second, I realize that I'm going to mess up. I hope that you realize you are going to mess up. I think it's inevitable. I mess up all the time. I think what really matters isn't whether or not you mess up when you're trying authentically to do this work. I think what matters is how you respond when you've said the wrong thing or done the wrong thing. And that's what I really hold. I think it's important to listen and do repair work. I think that's more important than trying to never mess up. And I think many of our relationships with other people, our relation involve a lot of listening and repair work. The third thing I'm going to say is I think we need to focus on relationality and relationships, build long-term relationships with individuals, build long-term relationship communities and organizations. I think for non-Indigenous folks working on or with or amplifying Indigenous issues, not to have a helicopter in and out attitude or to speak for people rather than listening to people is important, and just having those long-term relationships. And I'm emphasizing both the long-term part and the relationship part. That's where trust and accountability can really take the foreground.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. I kind of want to take a left turn here, although it touches on some of the things that we've been discussing. I want to ask one of my favorite discussion topics on this show and just in life, which is trade-offs, in specifically in the transition away from fossil fuel energy, decarbonization. So I'm really swayed by the argument that environmentalists are caught in the grip of what the scholar named Michael Gerard called trade-off denialism. I'm wondering what you think of the difficulties of balancing the need to rapidly decarbonize with the need to do so in the most ethically and environmentally sound way possible. And this kind of does go back to tribal sovereignty, because a lot of the minerals, I think I just read like 80% of the minerals that are needed for a clean energy transition are on Indigenous lands. So this is a very live, relevant question.
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. My first response when everyone starts talking about trade-offs is that I think we need to think long and hard about whose lives are considered sacrificial or expendable in the need to move fast for all. You know, I think I hear arguments like that and I wonder, are you willing to sacrifice yourself, your family, and your favorite places first? Or is it folks who are imagining sacrificing other people, other places, other families for their own well-being? You know, who makes the trade-offs? And whose sacrifices are considered acceptable and whose lives are considered expendable when we're doing that work? I find it is often the most privileged who are privileged in that discussion, and folks who have less political power and economic power and cultural power who are considered expendable. So I think that's the first thing that I think we need to talk about. I also think we need to talk about who's making the decisions. You know, is it really my place to go out and say, I think these tribal nations should be sacrificed? I think that these folks who've already taken so much for the team, who are maybe not the, you know, are the ones who should continue taking, who giving more. I think we ignore a question of what should global decision-making look like? What is democratic decision-making look like? What does respecting tribal sovereignty look like when we talk big picture about these global trade-offs? I often find that it is folks who think they can speak for how the whole world should be. And I don't think it is my place as an individual to say, this is how I think we should solve the climate crisis. I think that needs to be a much larger conversation among a much larger set of people, and in a conversation in which my voice maybe shouldn't be the privileged voice. And so I'm always a little skeptical about folks with a lot of privilege who imagine that their voice should be the most privileged in those decisions and decisions about sacrifice. I'll say two other things about this. I really don't take the position that some lives and some ecosystems and some creatures are expendable for the benefit of others. I heard the scholar Stacey Alimo in a talk the other day, and they said they take the radical position that everything matters and that we need to take the leap and envision boldly about a world in which everything matters. And I really am swayed by that as a radical imagination. Climate chaos is a moment of transition. It's part of a long-standing history of various kinds of violence and crisis. No, I don't think it is the first or only existential crisis that many communities and peoples have faced. I think a number of Indigenous scholars and writers have talked about how it's only the most recent articulation of a long history of violence. And I think when you look at that framework, it really shifts the question about trade-offs. I'm not willing to back down from my vision of a just future for all. I think this is a moment where we need to be re-envisioning, letting our imaginations run wild, and not just recreating a moment of green apartheid because of expediency and urgency.
I feel like I should probably clarify what I mean when I talk about trade-off denialism in the environmental movement. So a couple visceral examples would be, well, we could talk about the Thacker Pass mine. I think a more useful example for what I'm talking about is floating offshore wind off of Oregon's coast. You won't find any environmentalist out there that says that we shouldn't get off of fossil fuels and use renewable energy to power but the things we need to power, right? And yet at the same time, many, many conservation organizations were opposed to floating offshore wind off the coast of Oregon because of very real concerns about how it would impact wildlife, migrating whales. You know, these things are real concerns, right? I guess my contention there would have been that you're having trade-off denialism if you think there's a viable third option in the short term, like what's worse for instance, migrating whales, like some amount of impediment, which would cause real harm, no joke, versus an unlivable ocean for whales and virtually all other marine life. That's kind of the trade-off denialism that I'm talking about.
I want to ask, I guess in moments like this on this trade-offs, I want to think about a couple of different things. One, I always think about who should be making decisions and are those the folks making decisions? And if they're not the folks making decisions, what are the folks who maybe should have more of a say? Mm-hmm. Think about, you know, when we're talking about species off the Oregon coast, I think about those species as having kinship relationship with tribal nations. And so what are the tribal nations saying on a particular issue? I think that's really important. I think it's important to think about what are we doing in the moment? Are we acting in out of a sense of urgency and crises? Or are we thinking about our long-term vision of community and justice. Mm-hmm. There's an Indigenous environmental philosopher, Kyle Pells White, who argues that a lot of environmentalists respond in a moment of crisis and urgency and sort of fear of apocalypse, that whereas a lot of the Indigenous groups, the tribal nations that he works with and is familiar with, focus more on kinship and seeing moments of potential crisis as moments of opportunity, of moments to build kinship, build relationship, build community, rather than as this moment we need to just jump fast and act. And so I think about that, or how are we, or is this a moment in which we're jumping into action when we could be thinking about this as building up our communities and building our relationships? Mm-hmm. I certainly do think that as individuals, many of us, especially many of us who've had more privileged lives, need to make sacrifices. And what are those sacrifices? I think there is a problem of sort of exporting sacrifice to other places and other peoples.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to hold all of those things at the same time and ask, what are my values, and am I leading to my values? And knowing that there's going to be difficult decisions to be made, but that it has to be a world in which we're not imagining those who've contributed the least to climate change are the ones who are making the most sacrifices to continue to protect the lives and livelihood of those who've contributed the most to climate change.
Yeah. Can I push you just one more time? Because I agree with so much of what you're saying. I think that the way I look at it is, asking the people least responsible and the non-human communities least responsible to bear the biggest damage is basically what we're doing now. Which doesn't negate the point that you're making, it just, I feel like it's worth underlining that, like, business as usual is the worst possible route that we could go. That is what is causing the most harm to the people and plants and animals least responsible. I think in a values way, I am so moved by the things that you're saying and the things that other folks that you're bringing up have said. I used to work in politics, so part of my brain is cynical politics brain, and I want to try this on you. I sort of see two tracks that don't have to be exactly parallel with each other. Like, we have a track of bringing humanity, especially the Western world, you know, capitalized world, whatever you want to call it, back into harmony with each other and with the rest of the planet. And then there is the track of decarbonization. And I think a lot of folks want to tie those two things together as if they have to happen on the same timeline. My proposition is that they don't have to happen on the same timeline. And that if we're asking people to change in the way that folks like you and myself might want the world to change, then basically what we're setting ourselves up for is just more authoritarian takeovers. I just believe that politically, like, we have to look at what kinds of sacrifices individually we're willing to make, but that only extends so far in terms of our carbon debt, just to get to the point where we could heal our relationship with the planet. Does that make sense?
It does. I think I understand what you're saying. I guess I would add that I just, or sort of counter in some ways, I think we can't talk about decarbonization without talking about degrowth. And personally, when I think about what kind of political issues I'm going to work on or spend my time on and focus on growing, it's going to be on things like, you know, where, who's using all these fossil fuels? Who are the bigger users of fossil fuels? For example, we know the military is. Mm-hmm. You know, what that might be a political issue I'm going to choose to spend my time on, rather than something that's going to cause a certain set of harms that I maybe feel conflicted about. I think, and I certainly could hear the argument that I am perhaps more utopian and less practical. I don't necessarily personally think that's the case, but I do think that we all have limited amount of energy for the political organizations and the political projects we work on. And I'm going to put that energy into work that feels to me like it's less harmful than work that feels like it's asking for harms I'm not comfortable with. I mean, I do want to sort of stand on this idea that part of the problem of our society is a narrative of expendability. And I just want to push back on the idea that there are lives or ecosystems that are expendable. When we talk about for the greater good, I think we need to talk about for whose greater good, right? If you go back to Pinchot's idea of conservation for the greatest number, for the greatest good, for the greatest number over the greatest period of time, that itself can be a very, I don't think Pinchot is sort of, I would say that I think that line of thinking can lead to ecofascism and authoritarianism because it encourages the sacrifice of the least politically powerful. And I'm just not comfortable endorsing that.
Well, that is totally fair. And I take your point. And I think I pushed you enough on a topic that I didn't even invite you here to talk about. So I appreciate your generosity in talking through it with me. You did bring up ecofascism, which was one of my last questions. You also discuss ecofascism and how we can kind of fall into ecofascist tropes in the environmental and conservation world. Some folks might never have actually even heard that phrase. So what is ecofascism?
So I think at the most basic level, it's a co-articulation of environmental ideals and fascism. And ecofascism often explicitly advocates violence. Fascism itself has a longer history of particular views linking around the environment, linking ideas about racial and ethnic purity to environmental purity. I think we're also in a moment of articulation in a climate change narrative, that there's scarce resources and that white communities often perceive themselves as needing to be protected from foreign or racialized others who are at best seen as competition for scarce resources and at worst are seen as the cause of harm to the environment that's creating this scarcity or this crisis. So I would say there's a longer history of eco-fascist discourse in both fascist fascism itself and in environmentalism. We see this really showing up in some of the mass shootings in the last few years. And think about the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand. There's a shooting in El Paso and a Walmart, where in both of those cases and in some others, the manifestos the shooters left behind were explicitly explicitly eco-fascist. Alexander Ross Reed has argued that fascist ideas creep into popular culture as a form of soft power that comes before fascist takeovers. And scholars like April Anson and Alexander Minrinsky have argued that eco-fascist ideas are doing the same. And that's really what I'm concerned about with eco-fascism. I don't think the majority of people listening to your show believe in violence or authoritarianism to address climate change. But I think there's ways in which it's popular culture or the ways in which we talk about things can contribute to eco-fascism and sort of build more comfort with eco-fascist ideas.
Yeah.
A couple of examples of, I think, eco-fascist ideas that I would encourage people to be careful about is viewing humans as only having a harmful relationship with the Earth rather than the possibility of reciprocal or beneficial relationality. And you can think about during the pandemic, there were all these memes going around that humans are the virus, or those nature is healing memes, both of which sort of assume that the problem is humans rather than racial capitalism or colonialism or economic and cultural models and material realities. So I kind of discourage contributing to that view that it's humans that are the problem and all humans are the problem and it's humans only can harm the Earth. And I think another articulation of eco-fascist ideas that circulates in U.S. culture today is this idea that strong borders can protect the environment or that immigrants are harmful to the environment. This is linked to overpopulation discourse and the sort of, I think, problematic narrative of the population bomb. The Anti-Creep Collective, which does a lot of work around eco-fascism, has this line that climate change is a crisis for migrants, not a crisis of migrants. Yes. And I think that's a really important framework to keep in mind.
Uh-huh.
Fascism tends to blame problems on outsiders and are those who are othered within society instead of seeing those problems as part the fascists and other factors. And so I think we want to really be careful about blaming outsiders or those who are other within society for environmental crises and environmental problems rather than seeing them as folks who are either victims of those problems or have potential solutions for those problems.
You know, two of those examples I think are really salient. You know, I'm sure that some of our listeners believe in that overpopulation theory, that population bomb, and maybe haven't connected the dots between how that relates and can lead to that anti-immigrant sentiment. Or, you know, it's very fashionable in like radical circles to be misanthropic about people, right? And maybe they haven't thought through how thinking about humans as the virus, so to speak, is like anti-indigenous in a way and plays into fascist tropes. So thinking about some of these ways that it's just like part of the air we breathe, I think is really important. So thanks for highlighting some of those. Did you have anything else to add?
I'm going to suggest that folks who are interested in learning more about this can check out the Against the Eco-Fascist Creep. They have a zine which uses Marvel movies to address many of these myths and start to unpack them in ways that might be helpful for listeners who aren't quite with the quick summaries I'm providing here.
And how do people find that?
I will send you the link to include in the notes, but if you Google Against the Eco-Fascist Creep, you can find the zine online. The Association for the Studies of Literature and Environment has it highlighted on their website.
Thank you. Yeah, and I will definitely link to as many of the things that we've been discussing today in our podcast show notes as possible. You've been so generous with your time. As we start to wrap up, is there anything that I've missed? Anything you want to get included in the discussion?
I don't think there's anything. We've talked about so much. I don't feel the need to add anything to our conversation. I'm really thankful for the time to have these conversations. Oh, I do have one more thing I want to say, actually.
Yeah.
I think fascism
is bad.
We're in a moment of authoritarian. Fascism is bad. We're in a moment of authoritarian takeover. And I think it's really important that this is a moment in which we be bold, that the history of the McCarthy era, other histories of fascism has told us that you give an inch, they take a mile. This is a time to stand up, make sure you're on the right side of history.
100%. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. It's amazing how we can talk this long and only gesture at what is going on in the larger politics. Well, I don't usually ask this question, but you've given so many wonderful recommendations, and I'll ask you to email me some of those afterwards. But did you want to re-highlight any of those, like, book or literature recommendations you made earlier, or any other recommendations for folks in terms of reading articles, etc.?
I encourage everyone to read work by Kyle Powes White. I encourage folks to read Dark Laboratory by Tala Goff. I encourage people to read Mark David Spence's Dispossessing the Wilderness and Jessica Hernandez's Fresh Banana Leaves. And anything you can find by Carolyn Finney and Tia Miles.
Wonderful. Sarah Wald, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your being willing to come on and have this big, wide-ranging discussion. And I respect the work that you do so much. So honored to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining me on Coast Range Radio.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Check out the podcast show notes for all of Sarah's great recommendations. We are an independent, volunteer-run production. If you like the show, please tell your friends about us, follow Coast Range Radio on the Instagrams, or best of all, directly share it with at least a couple people by texting the link to our podcast feed. Once again, the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out anytime. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
Some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s.